wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Bill Resnick talks to Labor Notes editor Al Bradbury about new labor movements and the future of labor unions. Patricia Kohlberg speaks with filmmaker Jan Hocken and reproductive rights activist Sierra Romsberg about reproductive justice. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker pay tribute to Southern California-based author, activist, and historian Mike Davis. And book mole Larry Bolden reviews Sue Miller's 2020 novel, Monogamy. First up, writers, economists, and the left press have long critiqued the growing inequality of U.S. life and insisted that the many millions of low-wage service workers were necessary to the operation of society and deserve the wages and benefits that make for economic security. Bill Resnick talks to Al Bradbury, editor of the monthly journal Labor Notes, about the rapid self-organizing of workers at Amazon, Starbucks, and many other local franchises which rely on low-wage service workers. Here's Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Al Bradbury, welcome to KABU here in Portland, that you know so well.
Thanks, Bill. It's great to be back.
Al Bradbury started her career in labor as a researcher and organizer for Local 49 of the SEIU here in Portland. And while here, she hosted Labor Radio on KABU, this radio station. She then moved to New York as a writer for the monthly journal Labor Notes. It's the voice of radical labor, the people working to put the movement back into the labor movement. She started as a writer for Labor Notes, a couple of years later became a co-editor, and was recently named editor. So Al Bradbury, this summer's Labor Notes conference, it happens every 2 years, it's the goal place for radical labor to meet and talk and get inspired. This year was another attendance record, a large increase, over 4,000 workers this year. This year, it featured, among much else, many of the key workers at Amazon, Starbucks, many other low-wage service workers, mostly young people. These shop floor people organized their fellow workers. They won elections to form unions. Amazon, an 8,000-worker warehouse. At Starbucks, quite a few locations have filed for an election. And, of course, other groups of service workers. That was completely unexpected. This was an electrifying moment for all of us committed to social and economic justice. And for many of us, this spontaneous, in quotes, worker self-organized uprising was seen as the route to a new labor movement and the future of worker power. Others, though, also on the radical left, they're committed to what they call deep organizing. And they have reservations about the momentum organizing. They've contended that these new union leaders, in fact, have reached out and learned from the radicals in today's unions, but need to think about how to structure and operate in order to maintain over the long run commitments and enthusiasm. So first, Al Bradbury, tell us about why this momentum organizing was so enthusiastically embraced by much of the radical left. And then later in the interview, we discuss the deep organizing model, that they are potentially quite compatible, and the combination could actually hold the future of the labor movement. First, though, why Amazon, Starbucks, and so many others were so welcome and indeed electrifying?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the first thing to say is that these wins were very exciting because we all thought they were impossible. If you had asked me a year ago if it was possible to win a union authorization election in an Amazon warehouse with its huge turnover and with the employer's ample resources to spend on union busting, I would have said, no, it can't be done. And to win at all of these Starbucks outlets similarly, these were the kind of things that existing unions were mainly not even attempting to do because employers have become so sophisticated in their union busting methods. There's a whole industry. And in sort of defensively, unions have developed a set of very stringent criteria for how to assess what it's going to take to win. You really need every person committed and, you know, conduct a lot of the organizing in secret. And then you go public with a super majority and you expect that you're going to lose some of that majority once the employer starts applying the screws. Many unions have given up on organizing on a large scale altogether, have refocused their energy on legislative campaigns or on trying to get labor law improved. So we don't even see many unions embarking on these big union drives. So the fact that these campaigns were won, that they were organized, you know, with little resources, largely by the workers themselves, without a huge amount of support from institutional unions at first, it's pretty exciting. And one thing it says is we are in a moment of opportunity when, you know, maybe some of the rules we thought we knew about what it takes to win and how hard it is to win might have shifted because of the various circumstances of the moment we're in. I think, you know, you could list out a number of things that are unusual about right now. One big one is that workers have a lot of leverage because employers want to hire. There's a so-called shortage of workers everywhere. If you get fired from a job, it's not as scary as it used to be because it's easier to get another job. And people know that and are willing to take greater risks. People also have a lot of reason to be angry and fed up, having endured the various outrages of the pandemic, when billionaires managed to get even richer while letting workers suffer and die on the job. You really exposed the callousness and greed of the ruling class. So there's a lot of reason to be mad. Inflation, wild inflation, is driving up the prices of everything. People, you know, want and need a raise. And, you know, in the sort of general chaos and apocalyptic conditions, I think, affect the context that younger workers are thinking, too. So it's exciting, I think, also to people who have spent decades in the labor movement to see a young generation of people embracing unionism, calling it their own, making it their own. It gives you a sense that there is hope. You know, in the time I've been working in the labor movement, we keep seeing union density steadily decline. The percent of the workforce that's in unions, you know, just keeps going down and down. And you have this sense of like, is our movement just going to, you know, eventually sort of dwindle to nothing? So this upsurge of workers organizing themselves, spreading the idea of unions, doing it very quickly and winning campaigns, you know, really gives a sense of hope.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I've been talking to Al Bradbury. She's the recently appointed editor of Labor Notes. She once, in fact, was an organizer, researcher here in Portland, and in fact was one of the hosts of Labor Radio on this radio station. We've been discussing the extraordinary, greatly inspiring set of union victories at Amazon, Starbucks, other places. The kind of organizing that Al Bradbury discussed, I think it's called momentum organizing because it comes in a period of great ferment in the United States. I think everybody is on the left is both amazed and pleased by the momentum uprising, by the capacity of the young people to win an election without having laboriously gotten a very large percentage of the workers to sign themselves as supporting a union and seeking a union election. They really go in there. But there also is a critique of those momentum organizing advocates and practitioners who see the unions as too old-fashioned, stodgy, unwilling to take risks, bureaucratic. And the critics are also, though, from the left. This is not coming from the established unions who marvel at what's happening but don't know what to do, although some of them are moving. Tell us about the critique and, in fact, an alternative practice that seemed to be being dealt with, considered to be rivals, which in, later in the interview we'll talk about. It's the fact is they're really very compatible in many ways. Tell us, though, about the critique that momentum organizing has come from these seasoned but extraordinarily capable radical people.
I think it's possible to make too much of this distinction because I think that both what you're describing as momentum organizing and what you're describing as deep organizing have a lot in common, and most people sort of engaging in either would mostly overlap. But, it, you know, an argument can be made that we should be careful of romanticizing too much the spontaneous structurelessness of the moment, because in order to build and maintain power, you do need to build institutions and structures that will last. I was talking recently with a leader in the Canadian Postal Workers, who's local, had a series of direct actions on the job where members got tremendously excited. They fought off overreach by management by, you know, taking collective action together on the shop floor. And this activist thought that this would transform his local, but he said after a little while, that energy dissipated. People don't want to be fighting the boss all the time. So you do need to build structures that maintain the lessons of the moments when you have action and excitement and pass them along so that as a union, you're building power over time and not just having these flurries of energy. The question of how quickly should you move to an election? There are a set of criteria that good organizers usually use. And I think the methods that they taught me as an SEIU organizer are basically the same as what the AFL-CIO Organizing Institute teaches, is basically the same as what we would teach in a Labor Notes Secrets of a Successful Organizer class, or Jane McAlevey teaches in her classes, that you aren't just trying to mobilize the people who are already pro-union. You're trying to figure out who are the real leaders in a workplace, you know, prioritize getting them on board and networking them together, build connections between them, map out the groups, and commit together to take action together and to go further than you maybe were prepared to alone. Those kinds of structures, that kind of change is part of how you change a workplace, not just taking one action together, but, you know, forming a communication network, staying in touch, building trust. So those kinds of things, you know, mapping out a workplace and really working to get the key leaders engaged in a structure that can be maintained and, you know, maintaining good lists are some of the things that are sometimes called deep organizing. But to me, I don't see a reason, you know, why these two ideas should be counterposed. I think most people engaged in organizing would agree that you both want to build power that lasts and you want to take advantage of moments of energy when they arise. And the fact that Amazon workers were able to skip some of those steps, not have sort of counted everybody or mapped an entire workplace of 8,000 is a great thing. It doesn't mean it'll always work. They lost at the next warehouse that they tried. You know, it's a moment when we'll have a better percentage of wins and it's maybe worth taking more risks, skipping steps sometimes, you know, to try and win what we can in this moment. But that shouldn't be taken to mean that we should throw out all those insights about how do you build lasting power in a workplace, how you consolidate what you've won and keep moving forward to win more, to get stronger in a way that can last in the long term.
Yeah. You know, one thing that both deep organizing, there's a lot of things on which they're completely compatible, but one that's important to me that stands out is that in both of them, they do not try to stay secret that what they're doing. They, in fact, want to be well known that there are people who are challenging the boss, including workers, some workers who put themselves on the line and get fired, which then leads to, of course, often real resistance and sympathy by people who had not known anything about unions and were maybe suspicious of them. But the union is defending their fellow workers who, in fact, had the guts to challenge their employer and they're then fired illegally. It seems to me that both of them, the Amazon workers especially, but Starbucks as well, they maintain this presence. They make it known that they're organizing. They're not trying to do it in secret. The Amazon people have this tent set up right in front of the Amazon warehouse. Of course, the Amazon warehouse goes on for a quarter mile. But they were leafleting always at the gates. It was said by one of them that we always had the tent staffed by our people. Sometimes the workers would go by 50, 100 times without ever coming in. But when they saw their fellow workers were there one day, they did come in. They really made and they gave out leaflets, have newsletters. It seems to me that's also true of the deep organizing. I remember reading about the hospital workers in Arizona. They also set up a tent in front of the hospital and kept it staffed by people, fellow workers. It seems to me that one of the important things is being proud union and raising the issues that workers are most concerned with.
I think it's certainly true that because labor has been in a place of weakness for so long, some of our organizing methods maybe suffer from coming from a place of fear, that we know the boss basically has more power than we do. And, you know, and we're going to try and organize covertly and see if we can get this through before the boss really catches on and brings down the hammer, because we know they have such a big hammer to bring down that often they can smash everything. So it is heartening and exciting to see that the Amazon workers were able to flout some of those truisms and, you know, be public and weather Amazon's campaign, though Amazon's retaliation has been no joke. A lot of people have been fired, you know, otherwise terrorized, and the same is true at Starbucks. This organizing we've seen, you know, spreading to other big brands around the country. Chipotle apparently got wind of an organizing drive and shut down the store before workers could win their election. You know, that may eventually be found to be illegal, but in the meantime, they will have lost their campaign. So it is no joke what the power that the employers have, and there's a reason why people have tried to organize in secret. But I think you're right that the moment calls for boldness and fearlessness, and in part, that fearlessness is what is contagious and exciting and spreads to others. And some of it is rooted in workers' sense of their real economic power, the leverage that we have right now. And some of it perhaps is inspired by workers' involvement in other movements, the Black Lives Matter movement. But also, I think, for whatever set of reasons, rejecting fear, saying, go ahead and fire me, that's all right, but we're going to stand up for our rights, is an exciting and inspiring thing, and it spreads, and other people want to join the same. And I would hope that unions and organizers, you know, take heart from that idea and spread it. I think the other thing that's important to point out about these campaigns that are winning recently is that they are rooted in the workers themselves. They're really sort of started by and led by the workers in their shops, which might sound self-evident about a union campaign, but it isn't always so. And I think because it's so hard, because we've developed this set of sort of counterintuitive rules, unions have sometimes been operated too much as like, this can only be done one right way, and it has to be done by the staffers who've been trained in how to do it the one right way. So like, you know, wait till we get there, we'll tell you how to do it, and then do it that way. And that approach can be very top-down, isn't very democratic or empowering, perhaps, to workers involved. The Amazon Labor Union, of course, is an independent union. The Starbucks workers are affiliated with a branch of SEIU, but in both cases, they've really been sort of grassroots efforts where, you know, some of the choices made by the workers are not ones that staff organizers might make based on their experience. But the fact that it's led by the workers, they're owning it, they're the ones talking with people elsewhere about, you know, do you want to do the same as us in your workplace? Well, here's how we did it, here's how you can do it. You know, not necessarily mediated by professional organizers. I think that's part of what is exciting and real about it, why workers are taking heart that they're, you know, they can talk to somebody just like them who's made the plan, who's done it from, you know, soup to nuts, and then they could do the same. And it's interesting to think about how can unions that are inspired by this moment, that want to take advantage of this moment, you know, give some of those tools, help spread that spirit to their members and be helpful and, you know, not in the way. I mean, I think that idea of there's nothing particularly mystical about organizing skills. They've been well known for some time and we can share them. We've seen a number of organizations doing that. I mean, that's some of what Labor Notes does. We do these online trainings, Secrets of a Successful Organizer, every month. Anyone can sign up and learn the basics of organizing. Jane McAlevey has been doing big online schools with people around the world teaching, you know, those same kinds of methods. This group, the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, that formed during the pandemic, the whole idea of it was, let's, you know, make direct connections between workers anywhere who are fed up with how their employers are abusing their rights or putting them at risk during the pandemic, put them in touch on the phone with an organizer somewhere who can help, you know, talk them through the basics so they're not held back, so they can go ahead and take action together. And the News Guild has an interesting program sort of on a union-wide scale that is trying to put some of these tools in people's hands in a more systematic way. So there's been this whole rash of organizing among journalists, both in newspapers and in online outlets over the last few years. There's sort of more interest and excitement than you could handle if you were saying, well, we have to assign a staff organizer of the News Guild to shepherd each of these campaigns. So they, you know, put a lot of the tools down and, you know, figured out, well, how do we sort of translate, boil it down into like spreadsheets that people can fill out and sort of checklists people can do? How do we know we're ready to move to the next phase of the campaign? And started doing this training en masse and figuring out how can members who've been through a successful campaign then, you know, jump right into helping the next group of members organize. And that kind of initiative where unions don't hold it all too close to the staff, like let the members pick up the skills and run with it, let the unorganized workers pick up the skills and run with it, that's necessary if we're going to organize on scale. So, you know, I think we shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater and pretend that there isn't any expertise or knowledge to be had about organizing. And I don't think anybody's really arguing that. But we should figure out how to share it quickly and digestibly so that people can pick it up and run with it, and we take as much advantage as we can of the moment we have.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on cable radio. I've been talking to Al Bradbury. She's the editor now of Labor Notes. She spends a good part of every day dealing with these kinds of issues, reporting on what's happening in the labor movement, about not just the labor movement, but the movement of the working class in this country towards thinking about a very, very different economy, which in fact one of my interests is that that new economy has to be sustainable, which will require enormous changes in the way we humans reproduce ourselves and reproduce society. It's good that socialism is now gaining a lot of converts because it's necessary for us to survive. Labor Notes actually reports on all of those subjects and gives you up-to-date monthly reports. Al, tell us how people can subscribe and learn more about Labor Notes.
Thanks, Bill. Anyone can go to labornotes.org. That's labornotes.org. Where you can subscribe to our monthly magazine, you can sign up for our free weekly email newsletter, you can read our articles, and you can sign up for trainings and events that are coming up. We're doing in-person events this fall in the Twin Cities, New York, Alabama, but also every month we have online trainings for stewards, for shop stewards, for people who want to organize in their workplace or want to make their, you know, wake up their union and get it more active. We do a sequence called Secrets of a Successful Organizer. You can sign up, join other workers like you in all kinds of sectors, you know, in a Zoom training. Labor Notes is really the hub of rank and file to rank and file connection. That is sort of workers sharing with other workers. What are we learning in our organizing? You know, what worked, what didn't work, what are we struggling with, and helping build a stronger movement.
Al Bradbury, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you so much, Bill. It's been a pleasure.
They let you dream just to watch him shatter. You're just a step on the boss man's ladder, but you got dreams he'll never take away. In the same boat with a lot of your friends, waiting for the day your ship will come in and the tide's gonna turn and it's all gonna roll your way. Just wish the while you were.
Titus Jones and 9-to-5 Work Whistle, following Bill Resnick talking with Labor Notes editor Al Bradbury. Up next, Patricia Kohlberg speaks with filmmaker Jan Hocken and reproductive rights activist Sierra Romsberg from Democratic Socialists of America about reproductive justice and Jan Hocken's documentary Our Bodies, Our Doctors, which will screen Saturday, September 10th at the Hollywood Theater as a benefit for the Lilith Clinic, a new independent abortion clinic in Portland. Here's Patricia Kohlberg with more for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Good morning. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'm here today with documentary filmmaker and psychologist Jan Hocken and reproductive rights activist Sierra Romsberg with Portland DSA to talk about a special screening of Jan's film, Our Bodies, Our Doctors, at the Hollywood Theater on Saturday, September 10th. Welcome, Jan and Sierra, to the Old Mole and to KBOO Community Radio.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So the film, Our Bodies, Our Doctors, was in a number of festivals around the country and abroad in 2019 and won many awards, including Best Documentary Feature at the 2019 Portland International Film Festival. It's Labor Day today, and befittingly, the film focuses on the people who provide abortion services, those frontline workers who face increasing threats to their safety in the wake of the recent overturning of Roe. But the film also takes up issues of reproductive justice. I'd like to start with you, Jan. Can you say a little more about your film and how it relates to what's going on now in this country?
The film grew out of a project at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, Department of OBGYN, where they carried out research on abortion stigma and how providers were handling or responding to abortion stigma in this country and abroad. And it also grew as a project that would provide a way of thinking about abortion in a more complex way and ways of talking about abortion. So after I did the short film for them, I showed it to a number of my students and young people I work with, including many feminists, and was real surprised by how little even pro-choice activists knew about abortion. It was still very much behind this veil of mystique, either demonized and dominated by images produced by anti-abortion forces, or I think kind of idealized by pro-choice activists, but not really much that entered into the complexity and nuances of the abortion issue. And so in making the film, there was a story that emerged of the history of the abortion struggle, why it had become such a charged issue, what the investments are behind this fixation on abortion by the religious right, and how providers in this field have been involved in this over many decades, and how they draw on their own histories of struggle, including within the medical profession, where there was, if not overt violent threats, still stigma and kind of marginalizing of physicians and other providers who did this work. So I came to feel that these providers had enormous, not only knowledge and skill, but wisdom and ethical commitments that we could learn from. And certainly that's the case in the period we're in now.
Well, the national discourse around abortion, in my view, has not improved much from those days when you were conceiving of and making your film. So I'm sure that you have a lot to say in the film that adds to what we're talking about today. Sierra, you're an organizer with Portland Democratic Socialists of America, which is co-sponsoring this event with Hollywood Theater. Why did your organization decide to host the screening, and why should people come out and support it?
Yeah. Well, thank you. I can give a little context for those who are unfamiliar with DSA. The Democratic Socialists of America is the largest socialist organization in the country with over 92,000 members. It's a big tent organization, meaning it covers a broad range of political and activist issues, all while maintaining this radical idea that we should live in a society that caters to human need and not profit. There are branches in hundreds and hundreds of cities, including Portland. So our chapter, Portland DSA, has created a reproductive rights subcommittee within its larger health justice working group to focus on reproductive justice and abortion during this time. We decided to host this film screening after working with Jan and realizing that it would be a fantastic way to support the Lilith Clinic, which is the only independent abortion clinic in the entire state of Oregon. So even though many people have, you know, reported recently that Oregon has some of the strongest laws or protections for abortion in the country, clinics everywhere are being inundated with work, higher stress levels, and not to mention the legal complications. So the Lilith Clinic is also providing trainings for outside abortion care providers. I know that there is a clinic member who is also a DSA member who has trained Planned Parenthood staff recently. So all around, it was just a very, you know, important issue for us to support and to support our local clinic. And I feel like what better way to do that than by screening this unbelievably relevant and frankly beautiful film about abortion and abortion care providers with a particular focus on Portland and the Pacific Northwest.
Is there anything else that sets the Lilith Clinic apart as a new independent clinic? And by independent, I think you probably mean that it's not attached to the major healthcare system in Portland or around the state?
Yeah, it's not.
Or Planned Parenthood.
Right. That's exactly right. It's not attached to the major health institutions. It's not even attached to, you know, a larger system like Planned Parenthood is. So it's just important for us, you know, I think when everyday people hear, oh no, abortion rights are under attack, what do? Right? We stand up and fight back. So let me go and donate to Planned Parenthood. Let me go and donate to the ACLU, you know, because they're going to be fighting for my rights and my protection, right? And so people often sort of maybe gloss over or look over the smaller clinics in their areas. So the Lilith Clinic has been accepting patients from out of state. They've been helping with accommodations. They've been helping people travel in, even from rural communities within Oregon. It's difficult for people in rural areas to access the care that they need. So just was very, very important for us to reach out to them and build a relationship with them specifically.
DSA has also been organizing for the Healthcare for All campaign for universal universal and equitable access to quality health care in Oregon. It's a constitutional amendment. It's going to be coming up on the November ballot. The film recognizes abortion as an essential part of health care. Can either of you talk about how abortion care relates to health care justice in general?
In the film, we were working with two commitments to hold them together and avoid a kind of forced choice approach to storytelling. And one is a focus only on abortion and the worry that if abortion is just folded into healthcare, it gets lost and marginalized because many people are uncomfortable with abortion, even using the word, although now it's refreshingly out there a lot. But we also wanted to deal with abortion in its own terms, what makes it so charged, what's important about it as a determinant of women's lives and freedom and participation in society, but also is something very culturally and symbolically loaded for people. On the other hand, we wanted to bring abortion into a kind of continuum of care as part of reproductive justice, as part of everyday health care. And so many of the scenes follow abortion in its kind of routine ways that it's provided in kind of familiar clinical settings. On the other hand, you see a particular commitment to care and support in these clinics, feminist principles of healthcare that I think have had a profound effect on our healthcare system and challenging the dominance of doctors, of hierarchies in medicine. And so it's not just about access to abortion, it's about a vision of healthcare that's oriented toward everyday people and their needs, where they have a voice in their own care and more democratic principles of healthcare delivery.
Well, the idea of reproductive justice is really more than just having access to safe abortion. Sierra, would you want to say anything more about that from the DSA perspective?
Yeah, for sure. Definitely from the socialist perspective, as a socialist and as a member of DSA, I can say that the organization believes that abortion is a human right because healthcare is inherently a human right. I think many people have described our current healthcare system in this country as barbaric. That's often a term that's thrown around. And I would tend to agree. I think that when you have a massive privatized for-profit healthcare system that's most often tied to your employer, it's not a system that's designed to work for everyday people, everyday working people who need to work to survive and thrive. So when you have this healthcare system that forces, you know, parents to wait outside the ER in the parking lot with their toddler running a fever of 104, you know, waiting to see if things get worse, weighing the cost of a trip to the ER with the child's life or an ambulance ride or emergency surgery, that's the sign of a broken healthcare system. So DSA believes that we should have free abortion on demand for anyone who needs that care at any time, but that starts with a fair and just medical system like Medicare for All or a single payer system. So you can, you know, I think the socialist perspective is that you can make abortion legal, but until the medical system can support people living in those rural communities, people in lower income neighborhoods, people who need to travel for healthcare, you know, people who depend on childcare, people with disabilities, et cetera, until you have these healthcare protections in place, even a legal abortion may not be enough. And so with this in mind, to sort of wrap up that thought, Portland DSA does have a health justice working group that focuses particularly on winning Medicare for All, winning queer and trans healthcare access, abortion access, disability justice, because all of those struggles are inextricably linked.
I want to add to that also the important leadership and organizing Portland DSA carried out around the successful legislation around pre-K childcare here in Oregon. And reproductive justice involves, as Black feminists brought into the movement in the 1990s, the right not only to terminate a pregnancy, but to raise children in a healthy way and sustain caregivers as well. So DSA has been very involved in organizing around the right to childcare and a healthy environment. Climate justice is also an issue of raising healthy children where poor minority communities are much more in areas where children have high rates of asthma being exposed to pollutants.
So unlike most other cities, Portland does have a long pre-Roe history of being a haven for safe and inexpensive abortion services. That all changed with the post-World War II crackdown on abortion, not unlike what we're seeing today. But Oregon does have very progressive abortion laws in this moment. Can you, either of you, talk about what's happening with abortion care services in Portland and around the state right now? Are we in danger of losing abortion rights here in the state?
I would just say that we're almost always in danger until there's something codified in law, right, that protects it. I think Jan knows quite a bit about the Providence healthcare system, Providence Medical System, which is a Catholic hospital system that's a major player in Portland.
Yeah, and throughout Oregon and the Northwest, Providence healthcare system controls 30 to 50% of the hospital beds in the Northwest. And even though most abortions are performed in local clinics, the film takes up why hospital access to miscarriage management and abortion are so vital for women who have require some special monitoring during their procedure. And you cannot have that service is not available to you if you're a Providence healthcare member. And so even with the Reproductive Health Equity Act that passed the legislature in 2017, became effective in 2019, it required insurers to provide free coverage for reproductive health care, including abortions and contraceptives. And Providence has not complied with that law. And an audit from 2 years ago found they were not complying. There are these big institutions of all kinds of workarounds and ways of stalling and deferring or nominally complying, but not really complying with these laws. So I think many people are not aware how powerful the bishops' ethical and religious directives are in ethical and medical directives and how much they control what happens and the restrictions that are in place in the Catholic healthcare system. So it's not just the crazy evangelicals on the corner with their signs of bloody fetuses. It's often these corporate controlled healthcare systems that are still very much aligned with what the Supreme Court has been doing, including overturning Roe.
Well, and Portland is saddled with an extremely conservative archbishop who is an anti-abortion activist, and I'm sure that his influence is being felt. Well, before we close, tell us about the event itself, which is a fundraiser for the Lilith Clinic. How can people learn more about the event and how can they get tickets?
Yeah, the event is Saturday, September 10th. It is from 2 to 4 p.m. You can purchase tickets on the Hollywood Theater website. So you could either Google Our Bodies, Our Doctors, Hollywood Theater, or you could go to the Hollywood Theater's website, hollywoodtheatre.org, spelled the British way, T-H-E-A-T-R-E, hollywoodtheatre.org. Go to their events calendar and find it on September 10th and purchase the ticket that way. What's cool about this event is there's actually a Q&A after the film screening, immediately after. So we're showing the film and then doing a Q&A. I'm going to be hosting this panel with Jan, our director, and then as well as Dr. Shivarini, who is featured in the film as an abortion care provider, and Judith Arcana, who is actually a feminist author and one of the original Janes who worked in the Chicago underground in the 60s and 70s, providing illegal and safe abortions for people when it was illegal. So it's going to be a really interesting Q&A, open discussion for audience to ask questions. And all of the ticket sales are going to the Lilith Clinic, which is exceptional. And we're very, very happy to partner with the Hollywood Theater on this.
Okay, great. I hope people come out. I'm personally looking forward to the event. Any further comments before we close?
No, I think the question you began with at the beginning will be the question that we'll be taking up in the Q&A, Patricia. How can we draw on the lessons and the knowledge and the wisdom of these providers in the film in charting a path forward during the rough road after Roe?
So I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I've been speaking today with Jan Hocken and Sierra Romsberg about the September 10th screening of the documentary film, Our Bodies, Our Doctors. And we'll put a link up to the Hollywood Theater website on the webpage for this show. Thanks, Sierra and Jan, for coming on the show today. It was great to have you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Patricia.
That was Sisters, written and performed by Shelley Short, following Patricia Kohlberg, Jan Hocken, and Sierra Romsberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Now, here's Jan Hocken with Mike Snedeker, paying tribute to Mike Davis, Southern California-based author, activist, urban theorist, and historian who is in the late stages of terminal cancer. Davis wrote Planet of Slums and City of Quartz and more than a dozen other books. As a journalist and essayist, Davis has written for a number of left publications, including The Nation and New Left Review. Here's Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Mike Davis was interviewed in July by the Los Angeles Times and asked to reflect on his legacy as a prolific Southern California-based writer, urban theorist, and historian. He's perhaps best known for City of Quartz, which tells the story of Los Angeles, that glittery dream machine that Davis portrays as a corrupt metropolis built on graft and racist policing. The 76-year-old Davis is in the terminal stages of cancer, but describes his state of mind as fairly cheerful. Thanks to California's Death with Dignity law, he has some control over the final months of his life and the timing of his death. Well, Mike Snedeker, you are among those of us on the Old Mole who feels sadness about the prospect of losing this great intellectual soon. You have a long history as an appellate attorney fighting for the rights of defendants in some of those same brutal places that Mike Davis chronicles in his books on Los Angeles. How did you come across his work?
It was a minor miracle. In 1990, I was appointed to represent a black man accused, convicted, and sentenced to death for machine gunning to death a police officer who was picking up his kid at a daycare center. It was a notorious crime in Los Angeles. They closed down freeways and memorials, and the trial lasted 3 years. Shortly after my appointment, the whole snitch scandal erupted in Los Angeles. It turned out in the 80s, almost every serious crime had some jailhouse informant or snitch conveying a vicarious confession to the jury, where supposedly the accused spilled his guts out and acknowledged doing the crime. This was like a factory of confessions. And there was a big scandal, and I was invited to go down to Los Angeles and visit the Jailhouse Informant Litigation Team, or JILT, right downtown on Broadway. Because in this case, there had been 23 possible snitches elbowing each other to get prime position. Because if they were chosen, they would get cash money, license to rape and rob, and all sorts of benefits would accrue. So I went down there to a place which I really wasn't familiar with, to Broadway, 9th and Broadway, where the building was. And it was a surreally hot August day. The street was just pullulating with people, almost all black, brown, and yellow, Korean speaking Spanish. And high above, you could see like a city in heaven, this dreamscape, these buildings, shadowy outline, which were impossible to get to. I finally made it up there after my day's work by climbing high up onto this surreal heavenly landscape of 80-story buildings, gardens, and even a little amphitheater, two people, because it was entirely deserted. It was so surreal.
Was this downtown L.A.?
This was downtown L.A. So I wanted to know what was happening. I read two books. One of them, Los Angeles, Capital of the Third World, by David Reif, was a kind of cheery book that says that L.A. is doing quite well. Essentially, the Mexicans and the Asians are recapitulating, the Italians and the Jews, and it's all tumbling right along pretty nicely. And then I found City of Quartz. City of Quartz explained everything that I saw. It showed how the downtown developments had taken place with deals cut with the black community when Tom Bradley was elected, where they would, in return for being hired at municipal jobs, allow disinvestment throughout the black community and development of a zone which was deliberately cut off from the lower parts of downtown on Bunker Hill. It explained the property, the rise of angry white people who had already paid for their children's education, resentful of paying property taxes, refusing to do it. He showed the L.A. noir, L.A. nightmare, how Los Angeles began as a white person's dream. It was a commodity sold back east. He explained the centers of power, the Protestant Republicans downtown, the Jewish Democrats on the west side, and he explained how hundreds of thousands of jobs had been lost to the black community by shifting away from manufacturing, and how crack cocaine had become the virtually only way to make money. He wrote about the black lash. He wrote, quote, "As the high-tech gulag of Pelican Bay suggests, the specter of the black criminal underclass has begun to augment, even replace the red menace as the satanic other, which justifies the trampling of civil liberties."
Mike, yes. Along that eloquent and visceral passage, Davis has been criticized by people on the left for not attending enough to working class and marginalized groups engaged in resistance, that it's overly dark and pessimistic. What's your take on that critique?
He wrote a 700-page book about resistance in Los Angeles developing in the 1960s. It's a nonsensical take. He writes about the power structures of Los Angeles. After reading his book, I thought, there's got to be a riot in this town. And the next year, there was. It turned out the police agencies were the last gasp of white people hanging on to power, and that power now in Los Angeles is distributed much more so than it was in 1990. But Mike Davis is writing about the power structure and how the power exerts itself is not something that he's doing. It's not his fault that LA is the way that it is.
Yeah. But Davis also is a passionate eco-socialist and quite unsparing in exposing the false solutions of greenwashing and the climate crisis and superficial reforms and showing how capitalism is driving much of the destruction of the planet. Have you come across that aspect of his work?
Well, yes. City of Quartz, if I had to pick the single best left political book, that would be it, because it's theoretically remarkably good. Its observations are acute, and they're always very well chosen. The guy has a knack for picking real topics. The Ecology of Fear, when he's got a brilliant chapter called The Case for Letting Malibu Burn, where he points out that there are pine trees and all kinds of plants in California whose seeds only open at temperatures of more than 400 degrees. That fire is an essential element of the ecological community. It's not a matter of if Malibu will burn, it's a question of when. And not only is he prescient about climate change and the increasing heat, but also he wrote about pandemics, the monster within us back 20 years ago with Asian flu. He predicted there will be inevitably pandemics that will rage to a greater or lesser degree throughout the entire planet. He writes really concretely and vividly, and he's just been my favorite leftist writer since I first read City of Quartz 30 years ago.
So you don't agree with critics that describe him as overly apocalyptic? The term overly apocalyptic seems redundant, but as apocalyptic?
Well, they said he was apocalyptic when he first published City of Quartz, and a year later, the apocalypse happened in Los Angeles. I mean, he wrote a book called Late Victorian Holocausts, which if you ever want a book showing how capitalism kills, that's your book. It indicates how tens of millions of people died due to colonialism in the late 19th century because starving populations were not allowed to eat the food that they had worked and grown and processed. No, I don't think he's apocalyptic at all. Los Angeles has changed in many ways for the better because of him. Frank Gehry, the big architect who designed, among other things, the Disney Hall, essentially credits Mike Davis for goading him to create urban space around that Disney Hall, because Mike Davis wrote so well about how urban space had been designed to keep away poor people. And he gave details. He has photographs of bum-proof benches designed for the Los Angeles transport system. He's had a great effect in many ways concretely on city administration. He's telling the truth, and he's projecting not every bad thing will happen. I mean, Malibu has not burned yet, but there have been very serious wildfires that he predicted would rage over the West, and it's hardly his fault that these fires are happening.
Yeah, the problem of attacking the messenger. Well, thanks, Mike, for sharing your thoughts. I think it's fitting to close with some words from Mike Davis. from the Los Angeles Times interview with him on July 25th. He said, "I'm in the terminal stage of metastatic esophageal cancer, but still up and around the house. But I guess what I think about the most is that I'm just extraordinarily furious and angry. If I have a regret, it's not dying in battle or in a barricade, as I've always romantically imagined, you know, fighting." Well, so I guess it's up to the rest of us to keep up the fight. Thanks, Mike. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker paying tribute today to author, activist, and urban theorist Mike Davis.
Here we go again. Bring the noise.
Yo, they should know by now that they can't stop this bummer.
Bring the noise.
First off, they keep telling me to turn it down, but yo, play the play, ain't going out like that.
Come on.
Public Enemy and Bring the Noise, following Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker, paying tribute to Mike Davis. Finally, this episode, here's Larry Bolden for the Old Mall Variety Hour, reviewing Sue Miller's 2020 novel, Monogamy.
I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and today I'm reading a book review for our book mall, Larry Bolden, of the novel Monogamy by Sue Miller. Larry begins with a quote from the novel. "He's been much more careful in his marriage to Annie, more careful and more faithful, yet not entirely faithful, which is partly what's making him remember the end with Frida, because he's done it again," end quote. Sue Miller has done it again, written an astounding novel about family life and all of its complexities. In her newest novel, Monogamy, published in 2020, Miller undertakes to describe in meticulous detail the marriage of Graham and Annie. I will not be spoiling the novel for you readers by telling you that the anatomy of this marriage is described after Graham dies in his sleep of a heart attack. Viewed as an ideal couple by those who know them, Miller shows us the underside of the marriage as Annie begins to deal with her grief. Both Annie and Graham have been married before. During the 70s, Graham and Frida had decided to experiment with an open marriage. Quote, "an open marriage. They'd agreed on it at first. It had been that era. The world was shifting and changing rapidly around them, and Graham had stepped into this altered universe eagerly, along with what seemed like half of Cambridge, compelled by all the things it seemed to promise, among them a different meaning for marriage, for sex. The problem was that Graham had been happy in this new world, and Frida hadn't. She tried. She dutifully had a few lovers in the first year or so. But then she got pregnant with Lucas and realized that she never really wanted any of it," end quote. As was so often the case, men jumped at this new freedom, while so many women simply went along with it, or pretended to, in order to preserve their marriages. It is Frida who steps away from the marriage, taking Lucas with her. Eventually, Graham and Frida become friends and share custody of their young son. Frida also, though not by choice, assumes the role of confessor for Graham, and he confesses to her his infidelity with a recently divorced woman in their circle of friends. Her name is Rosemary, and he also tells his oldest male friend about his new slip. Quote, "The problem is that Rosemary Gregory, the woman he slept with maybe four, maybe five times, has started to behave as if there's some kind of commitment between them, as though she has a claim on him. He needs to end it. But that's something he's never been good at, disappointing people, at being, as he sees it, unkind," end quote. After his death, Annie discovers that both his best friend and Frida knew of the infidelity, and it seems as if perhaps everyone knew but Annie. What is most amazing about Miller's writing is how completely she develops her characters and how thoroughly she describes their lives. Although describing only an incident here and there, a memory of the past, an anticipation of the future, it feels to the reader that they are being told everything in detail. Philosophers who called themselves phenomenologists argued that philosophy should be a description of lived life. And, as Iris Murdoch has pointed out, if this is indeed the task of the philosopher, then novelists are the very best at doing this. And Sue Miller is of the first rank in this description of the lived inner lives of her characters. In the past couple of months, I have read 4 of Miller's novels, all close descriptions of marriages and family life. The Senator's Wife equals the exquisitely detailed description of the slow dissolution of a marriage. While I Was Gone also displays the immense emotional intelligence of Sue Miller. It is hard to do justice to her novels by reviewing them, since their greatness is in the magnificent description of the relationships. She does not preach and tells us that she has no great insights about monogamy or marriage, but I think you will disagree with the author's own assessment of her work if you swim into her wonderfully articulated stories. I have been talking to you about the novelist Sue Miller, and in particular, her last published novel, Monogamy. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and this is Patricia Kullberg reading today for Larry.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for September 5th, 2022. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Patricia Kullberg, Larry Bolden, Jan Hocken, Mike Snedeker, and Bill Resnick, and to their guests, Sierra Romsberg and Al Bradbury. Before we go, a quick announcement. The annual Vancouver for Peace Fair is coming up on September 10th from 9 to 4 in Esther Park in Vancouver, Washington. The Vancouver Peace and Justice Fair began in response to the backlash against civil liberties in the wake of 9/11. The annual event builds community among the grassroots peace and justice groups in Southwest Washington and highlights the common goals of peace and justice at home, in our communities, and in the world. The Collective for Social and Environmental Justice at Washington State University Vancouver is among this year's many sponsors. For more information, go to VancouverPeaceAndJusticeFair.org. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in time at KBOO.FM. Just search for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.